And good evening. This is the WBAI Evening News for Thursday, June 6, 2019. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Today is the 75th anniversary of D-Day, the invasion of Europe by the coalition of allies who would eventually sweep across Europe and aid in the destruction of Germany's Nazi regime.
Then on the 5th day of June 1944, just as you see them here, a fleet of more than 4,000 ships put out from England. This was D-Day. Fourth anniversary of the Battle of Dunkirk, and the Allied armies were striking back.
D-Day means any unknown date set aside for a military operation. The exact day for the invasion of Europe would be determined by the weather, as 156,000 Allied troops ferried from bases in England hit the beach in Normandy in Nazi-occupied France. Waiting were 50,000 German troops of the Atlantic Wall led by German Arch-General Erwin Rommel. They would make a bitter, determined defense. By the end of the first days of the operation, there were more than 10,000 wounded and dead Allied troops and thousands of German casualties. The war would grind on through many epic battles before the eventual fall of Berlin nearly a year later. Today, few veterans are left, a number well into their 90s, came to hear speeches by France's President Emmanuel Macron and Donald Trump.
Today, as we stand together upon this sacred earth, we pledge that our nation will forever be strong and united. We will forever be together. Our people will forever be bold. Our hearts will forever be loyal. And our children and their children will forever and always be free. May God bless our great veterans. May God bless our allies. May God bless the heroes of D-Day. And may God bless America. Thank you. Thank you very much.
D-Day was the largest combined sea and land operation in history. It probably will never be attempted again. The invasion opened up the long-awaited second front that, combined with the Soviet Union's Red Army, changed the face of Europe forever. D-Day has many untold stories, often used as a propaganda foil for less noble military invasions. One of the little-known facts are the women spies who slipped behind the lines and in the days before the invasion cut nearly 1,000 vital communication and rail links between the Normandy beaches and the German commanders. This crippled the German response and allowed the Allies to seize their beachheads. Sarah Rose is author of D-Day Girls, the spies who armed the resistance, sabotaged the Nazis, and helped win World War II. The women matched the bravery and the derring do of the fighting men, but got none of the credit.
It was a fight of brute strength hitting the beaches, but there was also a crucial role played behind enemy lines, and that is, on the night of June 5th, the French resistance took out bridges, roads, trains, and made 950 cuts all across France so that Normandy was isolated. They also took down telephone wires and underground telecom cables, which meant that the Nazis had to broadcast their troop movements over the air. And between those two things, when the Allies arrived, Germany was significantly weakened. Hitler couldn't get reinforcements to the beaches. A trip that should have taken his tanks 3 days took 3 weeks. The women were part of that plan, like a crucial part of that plan. They were organizing the resistance. They were teaching the resistance how to use weapons. They were recruiting the resistance. Basically, the Allies had run out of men by 1942. They needed fluent French speakers. And the only people left were women. So they didn't, like, just get woke and open the doors to women. They realized that if they didn't invite them in, they wouldn't have this underground force ready for D-Day.
Who were these women, and what were they like?
Sure. So the key thing they all had in common was fluent, habituated French. There were three women in the first class that I focus on because each, in her way, kind of changed the world. One is Odette Sanson, and she was a single mother of three little girls. Her husband had already seconded to the war, and her government came to her and said, "We need you. You have a British passport. You're French-speaking. We need you to go to France, arm the resistance, train them. We need to turn you into a weapon, too. Will you do it?" And for any single mom who said, no, I've got three little girls, what do you mean? Like, that would be an understandable response. But Odette framed it in the conversation of a mother. She said, look, Europe's gone. There is not an allied boot left on the continent. There are no democracies left in Europe. What happens to my girls if Britain falls too? And that's it. There are no democracies in Europe anywhere, even Britain. What happens to them then? Like, shouldn't I, as a mother, do everything in my power? And my government is telling me there is something in my power I can do to change that. She got arrested, but when she escaped Ravensbrück, the evidence she took out with her helped put the leader of the largest women's prison in history behind bars and condemn him to death. Two other of her classmates were also similarly deeply involved in the end of the war and changing the outcome of the war. Andre Burrell was 22. She left school when she was 14, had pretty much no social prospects, but she was a fierce patriot. She was the very first female paratrooper, combat paratrooper, and she was sent to Paris to raise up resistance circuits all along the Channel Coast. So when the Allies arrived and the resistance was there to meet them, those were all circuits that had been started and seeded by André. And then there was Lise de Bessac, who's kind of our D-Day hero. She was in Normandy and second in command of the resistance forces behind enemy lines on D-Day and throughout the summer of 1944, when the war was extremely hot. The minute the Allies returned to the continent, there was a woman in charge of about forces, of actual soldiers. The resistance was counted at about 200,000 strong by the time the Allies arrived. She was in command of troops, armed and dangerous and doing all the same military work as men throughout the summer of 1944. And she did crucial work for Chaix, for the Supreme Allied Headquarters. They couldn't find the front. Once they broke out of the beaches, the front started moving so fast through France that the commanders couldn't find it on any given day. They didn't know where it was. It was just pushing ahead so fast. So she recruited runners and sent them to the front lines to radio, and then they would run back to her and her radio. She would tell London where the front was at any given moment. It was crucial for battle planning. And it was a woman, and we haven't heard about it because basically men have been writing these histories and women haven't until now.
Yeah. What led you to write this, and how did you find out this information?
Well, so I spend a lot of time in Hawaii, where I spend a lot of time with women in the military. And my friends there kind of defy my notion of what women in male spaces should be. Like, they're not tomboys. They're not junior dudes. They are extremely feminine and flirty and deeply credentialed, and they're operating in their jobs as women. And that was so interesting to me. It defied my expectations. And I knew that as of January 1st, 2016, American forces were lifting exclusions for any role in combat. So a woman now, if she can qualify, can do any combat role in the U.S. military. But that only happened 3 years ago. And I saw that coming. I knew I was interested in these women in the military, and I thought, well, I'll find a good woman in war story. I'll find an Afghanistan story. I'll find an Iraq story. And as I was reading around, I thought, well, who's the first? Like, there was always some first. Who was going to be the very first woman soldier? It turns out the very first woman soldier wasn't in Iraq or Afghanistan. It was 75 years ago in Europe, and we hadn't been hearing about it because their role was sort of dismissed as secretarial, or they were messengers. And nobody bothered to sort of recognize these women for what they were, which was soldiers.
Mm-hmm. And just to wrap up, what takeaway do you think people, what would you like to add as far as the takeaway?
I mean, the important thing to know is that they were crucially important to our strength and our war footing. There are things women do better than men. We aren't the same. And one of them is when you are recruiting underground soldiers, you are getting not the world's greatest fighting fit men. You're getting men at the fringes, teenagers, old farmers. The women were really good at listening to their concerns, their problems, and convincing them to go live in the hills, live badly, maybe not see their families ever again, to fight for France. Men hadn't been as well trained in caretaking and listening as women are from birth. So women had a kind of strategic advantage, and also we've mistheorized war. I think in part because We have our own continent to ourselves. Britain is an island, and the language of war in English is one of isolation. But war is actually a much more feminine place than we think of. France was overwhelmingly female. The men were in POW camps. The men had been conscripted for slave labor for Hitler. There were many more women in France at war than there were men. So if you're going to infiltrate a woman, she looks like everyone else. She's not suspicious. If you infiltrate a fighting fit 25-year-old who could otherwise be fighting, he stands out in an entirely female space. So it costs our war footing. It costs our national security to not think about war as a place where women are.
Sarah Rose is author of D-Day Girls, The Spies Who Armed the Resistance, Sabotaged the Nazis, and Helped Win World War II. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Another of the little-known stories of D-Day is that of the massive casualties suffered by French civilians in Normandy. In preparation for the Allied invasion, Supreme Allied Commander General Dwight D. Eisenhower had redirected Allied aircraft to prepare the ground for the invasion of France. A steady air campaign rained bombs and strafing fire down on the landing zones for months before the invasion, hitting access routes leading to the beaches of Normandy as well as strategic targets inland. Mark Wortman is a historian and writer for the Daily Beast. His article, Romanticizing D-Day Ignores Thousands of Civilians' Deaths, is a reminder that even in an event as uncovered by film, newsreel footage, and books of fact and fiction, there are new things to learn.
Well before D-Day, the Allies started basically softening the landing areas and inland throughout Normandy. Eisenhower's orders, they redirected the heavy bombers that were flying the missions over Germany to use them as basically artillery for attacking German positions in Normandy and using that as a way to ready for the D-Day assault. The trouble was that in using those bombers did not have much accuracy at all. I mean, even after the skies were largely cleared of German fighters in later 1944, you know, those bombers still were off target by at least 1,000 feet in all but about 7% of bombs dropped. And so the only way they could really take out a target was through saturation bombing. They sent wave after wave after wave of bombers. The results are that everything was obliterated around the target. But the trouble was that Normandy was filled with civilians. And before D-Day itself, there were already an estimated 11,000 to 19,000 Normans who were killed. On D-Day, within the first few days of D-Day, the bombing and strafing was intensified, and there were more than another 800 French civilians who were killed. Then, as the invasion of Normandy extended, the use of bombers became much more intensive against the French cities. For instance, there were any number of Normandy cities that were heavily, heavily damaged. Le Mans, Rennes, Saint-Lô, Le Havre. As the Allied forces advanced into Normandy and they began to meet resistance, the bombers were brought in. And particularly one city, Cayenne, in France, which was a city of 60,000 people, in the city there was a small German force that was basically stuck there. Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery, the British Field Marshal in command of British forces and Canadian forces, decided that it was going to be necessary to destroy the city to root out those Nazi forces. And so they sent massive waves of bombers over Cayenne and obliterated the city. It's estimated that there were about 3,000 casualties and 35,000 French citizens who were left homeless by this. And you can see photographs online. The rubble was just piled up two stories high. One journalist who went into Cayenne afterwards said the very earth was reduced to its original dust. And there's all kinds of questions as to whether that bombing was at all necessary, and some have even said that it amounted to a war crime. But it was a war crime carried out against people that we were liberating.
Did this bombing contribute to the bad feelings that existed after the war between the United States and France with the de Gaulle government? How did people in France feel about that towards the United States and the other allied countries?
That's a really good question. Now, if you go in and liberate a people by destroying their cities and killing their civilians, there's going to be inevitably a lot of unhappiness left after that. In the depictions and most of the books, not all the books, most of the histories of D-Day, you know, we see the French just cheering madly for their liberators coming in. And very, very seldomly do we see the destruction that was left behind. The French did not forget. The communists, French communists and de Gaulle used this anger that was directed at the Allies for their heedless destruction of these cities and other parts of France as a way to sort of leverage their way into power. And they resisted allying in NATO and other post-war Atlantic alliances precisely because there was so much resentment of what was done to them. There were multiple elements of that. The French, who'd always, of course, had strained relations with the British, were resentful that the British had pulled out at Dunkirk and sort of left them. The British also attacked, once the Vichy government was in place, the British attacked the French Navy in a couple major raids that caused a lot of damage and deaths to keep the French Navy from falling into German hands.
How should we reevaluate looking back on D-Day?
We need to, first of all, acknowledge the incredible heroism of the Allies who came ashore and the absolute necessity of ridding Europe and the world of Nazism, German fascism, and freeing Europe from what was truly a nightmare. Yet at the same time, we have to understand that there was a terrible price paid, not just by the liberators, but the liberated. We tend, when we whitewash that, when we overlook it, to romanticize what took place. This was a necessary war, but there's no good wars. Since D-Day, American political leaders have often recurred to those events as a way to justify wars that often have nothing to do with liberation at all. Dick Cheney explicitly used the comparison with D-Day to justify American forces going into Iraq as quote-unquote liberators, and obviously they were nothing of the kind.
Mark Wortman is a historian and writer. His article, Romanticizing D-Day Ignores Thousands of Civilian Deaths, appears in the Daily Beast. An estimated 11,000 to 19,000 Normans were killed during pre-invasion bombing. 800 more French civilians were killed within 2 days of the D-Day invasion. And in more news from the front, the final American cruise ship is set sail from Cuba after Donald Trump reimposed sanctions lifted by his predecessor, Barack Obama. Trump aims to cut off the cash flow to the island nation by limiting the number of granted travel visas and ending cruise ship stopovers, saying it helps prop up Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. The Department of the Treasury banned educational group travel, cruise ship stopovers, and private yacht visits by American citizens, as those are the most common ways that Americans visit the island. Art Heitzer is chair of the National Lawyers Guild Cuba subcommittee, which defends people who try and travel to the socialist nation. He says Trump's moves are being orchestrated by Florida Republican Marco Rubio and his national security advisor, John Bolton.
Any president has the ability to expand or narrow the definitions of 12 categories of what the U.S. government considers legal travel to Cuba, but they can't abolish them or add to them. Only Congress can do that. So there still are 12 categories of legal travel to Cuba, according to the U.S. government. And what Trump administration did in the last couple of days is they narrowed drastically the definition of one of them. That's educational travel. So if someone's involved in a formal program of education, even high school or college, and there's a Cuba study abroad program or something like that, that's not affected. But the broader definition of educational travel, which means that you go to Cuba, you interact with average Cuban family and things like that, and you learn lots of stuff because their lives are somewhat different than ours and organized in a different system, and they have strong points and weak points in their life, and we do as well, but they're often different. So that educational experience has sometimes been defined as people-to-people educational travel, and currently under Trump, that's not considered educational travel under one of the 12 categories.
Trying to kill the tourism industry that's burgeoning between the U.S. and Cuba.
Well, it's going to make people fly instead. People found it easier to get on a cruise ship and makes two or three stops in Cuba. They get back, sleep on the boat at night, and that seems simple, and their tour provider said, this is legal, don't worry about it. And it's a little more ambitious, but certainly not impossible to fly to Cuba. On U.S. Flights have not been affected.
What is Marco Rubio's role in all of this?
Central. According to Trump, Marco Rubio, Trump's foreign policy in Latin America is, quote, make Marco happy, end quote. Basically, this guy John Bolton, who's the National Security Advisor, and Marco Rubio, they are committed to destroy the Cuban Revolution, even though it's about 60 years late in the game. They have not given up, and that's the rhetoric, and that's their plan. Is to U.S. sanctions against Cuba, according to the U.S. government, are the most severe imposed upon any country. They're also by far the longest, so it's older than most people probably listen to your show. About 60 years in effect, never been removed. Even under Obama, they were only slightly tampered with. And it was explicitly written in April 1960 to impose hardship and hunger and desperation and overthrow a government on the Cuban people. The hunger comes and goes, and all that stuff is still going on 60 years and counting, and Trump's trying to make it more severe and hoping that the Cubans will give up, and I don't think anybody thinks that's going to happen, but they're tightening their belts again.
This is going to cause a tightening of belts in Cuba, you think?
Absolutely. No question about it. They've already changed some of the food distribution. People are pretty, I don't know if depressed is the right word, but not too far from that. They're very concerned in Cuba.
Is there any sort of
resistance? There's a lot of shortages, and they're getting worse.
There's a lot of shortages, and they're getting worse, you're saying?
Yeah, and that's U.S. policy design.
Is there any resistance to this? Anything that anybody can do or that's being done?
There is legislation, Senator Leahy, and you're in the state of New York, and I think Gillibrand is co-sponsored to allow freedom of trade between the U.S. and Cuba. So people could support that kind of thing. They could contact their congresspeople or senators. And there's groups such as Pastors for Peace, also based in New York and Harlem, which does travel challenges, and they're right now in the process of beginning a national tour of dozens of cities and having programs, and then they're going to Cuba without a license. They're going, the U.S. government says, illegally. They're going, they say, morally to Cuba and to be neighborly to our neighbors. So there's people doing travel challenges, and in fact, enforcement of the restrictions so far under Trump appears to be negligible. It could change. There's a 5-year statute of limitation. But so far under Trump, and for the most part under Obama and even the last 2 years of Bush, there has been very little, if any, enforcement.
Art Heitzer is chair of the National Lawyers Guild Cuba subcommittee, which defends people who try and travel to the island nation. And in local news, nearly 50 years after a police raid at the Stonewall Inn catalyzed the modern LGBT rights movement, New York's police commissioner James O'Neill apologized for what his department did. But not all Pride organizers are happy about the apology, Shane Sullivan reports.
The NYPD police commissioner's apology comes weeks ahead of the milestone anniversary of the raid and rebellion it sparked the night of June 27th to the 28th, 1969. That was a time when LGBTQ people were subject to arrest for showing affection, dancing together, even for not wearing a certain number of items deemed gender appropriate. Bars that served gay people often lost their liquor licenses, and others, like the Stonewall, were simply unlicensed. Raids were common, and an apology for the raid at the Stonewall Inn from the NYPD has been sought after for half a decade.
I think it would be irresponsible of me as we go through World Pride Month not to speak of the events at the Stonewall Inn in June of 1969.
NYPD Police Commissioner James O'Neill.
Well, I'm certainly not going to stand up here and pretend to be an expert on what happened at Stonewall. I do know what happened should not have happened. The actions taken by the NYPD were wrong, plain and simple. The actions and the laws were discriminatory and oppressive, and for that, I apologize.
Organizers of what is expected to be a massive LGBTQ pride celebration in the city this year had called this week for police to apologize. So had City Council Speaker Corey Johnson, who is gay. The pride organizers cheered O'Neill's remarks. James Falerino, a spokesman for NYC Pride, said, "The NYPD as an institution needed to take responsibility for what happened at Stonewall. This isn't going to undo the decades of violence and discrimination that our community has experienced at the hands of the police, but it's a good first start." Organizers of an alternative Stonewall anniversary march see O'Neill's comments as an empty apology made under pressure. The group called the Reclaim Pride Coalition said, "Where has this apology been the last 50 years?" The coalition, which is excluding police from its queer liberation march, is seeking a more sweeping apology from the NYPD. The group says transgender and minority LGBT people, among others, still face heavy-handed policing. The confrontation at the Stonewall wasn't the first time gay people protested or spontaneously clashed with the police. But it proved to be a turning point, unleashing a wave of organizing and activism. The police inspector who led the raid, Seymour Pine, said in 2004 that he was sorry, according to a news account that he gave at the time. Pine, who died in 2010, said officers were prejudiced about gay people, whom they didn't understand. NYPD leaders have expressed some regret before about the events at Stonewall, but until Thursday, they stopped short of a formal apology. In other news, the LGBTQ pride flag is flying over the New York State Capitol for the first time in state history in celebration of LGBTQ Pride Month. The flag went up over the Capitol in Albany Wednesday. In announcing the move, Governor Cuomo said New York State is grateful to the many New Yorkers who work to fight discrimination and work toward equality. Shane Sullivan, WBAI News, New York.
He's going to get a headache somewhere else instead, and he will be retiring very soon to join a certain Kaiser down in Dune. Adult, you bit know much more than you can chew. Come on, hold your hand out, we're all fed up with you. Adult, you toddle off, and all your Nazis too. Or you may get something to remind you of the old red, white, and blue.
And that's some of the news for Thursday, June 6, 2019, the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion of Europe. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Shane Sullivan. Our engineer is James Irsay. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for joining us.
And all your Nazis too. For you may